Good day. Today is Monday, 10th November 2025. And before I proceed with the remainder of this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to this programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch and listen to, you've liked what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact. Now, as has been true with most of my programmes recently, and indeed most of my programmes stretching back over the last 3+ years, most of today's programme is again going to be tied up to the situation in Ukraine. And to repeat again what I've been saying previously, we are, it seems to me now, at an inflection point in terms of the war itself. Over the last 2 days, I have been discussing the massive Russian missile and drone strike, which took place against targets, energy parts of Ukraine's energy complex. Well, roughly 2 days ago now. I understand that in Kiev, electric power has been mostly re-established. Though this is not true in other cities in Ukraine, but apparently there remain continuing problems with the energy system, and there are worries apparently within the energy supply system that the situation with energy supply in Ukraine might be difficult to put fully back into service, with worries, constant worries, about another Russian drone and missile attack as soon as the repairs are done. There have been reports, and these reports have appeared in a Ukrainian newspaper, Ukrainska Pravda, that Zelensky's office was absolutely furious when the Ukrainian energy company, Centrenergo, announced that the two big thermal power plants in Ukraine were out of action and were no longer capable of generating electric power, which was obviously true, and that officials from Zelensky's office then began to telephone and put pressure on the Centrenergo employees to get them to water down and retract the statement. And indeed, some hours later, a more moderately worded statement did indeed appear, which said factually that the damage had been done, but that it was being repaired and that work was being done to restore the electricity system. So in other words, Zelensky and his officials responded not so much to the crisis of the electricity system, but rather to what they saw as alarmist comments by Ukraine's energy producer, electricity producer, about the crisis in the electricity system. Something which is very much in keeping with Zelensky's entire approach to the war, which continues to be very much heavily weighed to it being, in effect, a media operation. Anyway, further examples of this were provided by an interview he gave to the British newspaper, The Guardian. Now, I am not going to discuss what Zelensky said over the course of that interview, which was absolutely standard fare from Zelensky, and which The Guardian reproduced in terms that were, as you would expect from that newspaper, strongly sympathetic and complimentary to Zelensky. What I will say is that over the course of this interview, the power in the room where the interview was conducted went out. The interview was plunged into darkness, but Zelensky continued with the interview nonetheless. And then after a few minutes, the electric power came back on again. Now, the Russians have been absolutely scathing about this particular affair. They say that the residence, which I believe is the Mariinsky Palace, not Bankova, the Mariinsky Palace is another presidential residence in Kiev. It was the favored residence, by the way, of the former Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych, who was overthrown during the Maidan crisis in February 2014. Just saying. Anyway, the Russians have pointed out that this particular residence, which the Russians have never attacked at any point during the conflict, has all sorts of electric power generators. It is not short of auxiliary power units. It can be fully brought back into operation in the event that there is a crisis in the wider electricity system. And that the whole thing was obviously a stunt whereby the Ukrainians, Zelensky's people, obviously wanting to make a point to The Guardian about Zelensky's sang-froid, his courage under fire, if you like, and also perhaps to communicate to The Guardian the importance of providing further air defense systems and such things to Ukraine. Anyway, that it was the Ukrainians themselves who turned the electricity off during the interview. Now, I believe this. I have no proof of that, but I believe this. It seems to me exactly right. And again, very much in keeping with the way that Zelensky has been conducting the war. If you want to see a full Russian account of this affair, or at least the Russian perspective on this affair, Ambassador Rodion Miroshnik of the Russian Foreign Ministry has given his own view about this, which you can find on the official Russian TASS news agency. Anyway, we've seen this massive strike on the electricity system, and Zelensky's people have both simultaneously been trying to play down in terms of the official communiques, official statements made by Ukraine's state electricity supplier, and play up perhaps in the interview with The Guardian. But nobody can doubt seriously that the Russians now are in a position to cause devastating damage to Ukraine's electricity system and perhaps shut it down entirely. Now, over the course of the last couple of hours, following my program yesterday, I received a private email from an individual who both has a military background and familiarity with energy systems in general. And I have absolutely no doubt about the qualifications, the outstanding qualifications of this person, about which I am fully informed. And I regard his comments as being definitive. Now, over the course of my program yesterday, I mentioned that the Ukrainians have complained about the fact that two substations connected to two Ukrainian nuclear power plants had been attacked. And I said that that appeared to me to be an escalation. This person, who is fully familiar with the way in which such plants operate, told me that there is no escalation in this kind of attack at all, that undoubtedly it would be a blow to the Ukrainian electricity system and power generation system, but that all power plants basically have such substations. Nuclear power plants are no different. And that in no way do attacks on these substations create dangers, risks in relation to the nuclear power plants. That is one thing that this person said, and I absolutely accept that. I think that there is no doubt about this at all. The Ukrainians, again, have been playing up this story about the attack on the substations. They've been trying to imply that it was an attack on the nuclear power plants themselves. This individual has clearly said that they are not. And again, as I said, I would treat the information he has given as definitive. He has also informed me that the theory that was expressed by John Helmer back in 2022, that the Russian attacks on the energy system in Ukraine were intended to understand its day-to-day operation and work out how it was repaired and how it was brought back into operation in preparation for a big offensive that would eventually come. Anyway, he straightforwardly says to me that he doesn't believe that explanation. He thinks that explanation must be wrong. He has pointed out what many people, by the way, have pointed out in the past, that the electricity system, the power generation system in Ukraine was created by the Soviet Union, and that the Russians already, therefore, have complete knowledge of it. Now, this person, who I should say is not Russian, that's all I'm going to say about him, says that on a visit to Moscow, and again, I'm not going to discuss the context of that, he actually had access to the plans of this whole system. And for that reason, he knows that this simply cannot be the case, that the Russians know everything that there is to know about this system. They have their own reasons, which perhaps are not easy for outsiders to work out, as to why they have been bringing the energy system in Ukraine to the brink of collapse over the last 3 years, but not to the full point of collapse, but trying to understand the system, as far as this person thinks, cannot be that reason. And again, I accept this. This must be an authoritative view by someone who I should say undoubtedly is both expert and fully informed about these matters. I should express my gratitude to this individual for the information he has provided, and as I've said already, I accept it as both definitive and authoritative. Anyway, so there we go. The Russians have demonstrated that they do now have the ability to switch off the system entirely whenever they wish. They built up enough ballistic missiles and drone systems and other things now, and they can knock out the entire energy system. Basically, it will. And by the way, also, if they do that, they would also knock out Ukraine's internet as well. They haven't chosen to do it, but it is now a matter of choice, not a question of capability. So we are at an inflection point there. And I would say that we are also now at an inflection point over the last, on the battlefronts as well. And I am saying this in light of information that has come pouring out from the battlefronts over the last 24 hours. And I'm going to suggest that the changes actually that we are starting to see are becoming dramatic. Now, here I'm going to say something briefly, which is that I remember that back in the late summer and early autumn of 2024, of last year in other words, it seemed that the Russians, in one part of the battlefronts, in the area west of Avdeyevka and Ocheretino, were at a particular point, they seemed to be advancing almost at will. Villages and settlements were tumbling under their control, one after the other, until eventually the Russians basically reached the area south of Pokrovsk, and then the advance slowed for a time, but only for a time, and we saw a whole string of important towns, Novogrodivka, Ukrainka, Selidovo, Kurakhovo, Ugleda, all of them fall one after another. So there was this very big breakthrough by the Russians last summer. But as I've said in previous programs, we are now seeing similar breakthroughs to the breakthrough we saw last summer, but they're not taking place as they did last year in one place on the front lines. They're taking place simultaneously in many places, even as the cauldrons in Pokrovsk and Kurakhovo continue to be sealed shut. Now, I'm going to quickly as I can, go through the events of the last 24 hours to convey a sense of the extent to which this is now true. Let's start with Pokrovsk, which is of course the main area of the battle, which has been attracting attention. And the Russian Defense Ministry, over the last 2 hours, has released its report about the situation in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And it says this: during the neutralization of the Ukrainian encircled units near Pokrovsk, units of the 1,435th Motorized Rifle Regiment, 2nd Army, liberated the village of Gnatovka. Gnatovka is a small village, essentially a suburb of Pokrovsk, located immediately to the west, to the east of Pokrovsk, in the central area of Pokrovsk. I believe it is a very, very small place, but the Russians have now cleared it. There's Russian operations continuing in another village called Rog. I'm not sure where Rog is. There is a village a little to the north of Gnatovka, but also to the west of Pokrovsk, called Rivne, which looks like a bigger village. Maybe Rivne is the Ukrainian name for Rog. The Russians have their own names for these places, and the Ukrainians have theirs, and it's not always easy to tell which which village is being referred to, especially given that the Russians, as I said, always use their own names for these places. But anyway, Gnatovka has fallen. Now, that is the least of it. As I said, it's a small place, but then the Russians continue to say this. In Pokrovsk, Russian assault groups conduct offensive actions in the Dnas micro-district, as well as in northwestern and eastern quarters in the Tsentralny district, mopping up the western part of the industrial area. In the past 24 hours, 244 buildings have been liberated. Now, that is a dramatic increase in the number of buildings that the Russians claim to have captured in Pokrovsk over any 24-hour period. And I think that essentially confirms the reports that we were getting yesterday and the day before, that the Ukrainians have essentially pulled out of Pokrovsk, that the entire garrison of Pokrovsk has evacuated Pokrovsk and transferred to Mirnograd. So there are still Ukrainian troops in a few places, but basically Pokrovsk now is fully under Russian control. There is a few micro districts that the Russians have to clear. There's some places in the industrial area to the northwest of Pokrovsk, close to Gryshino, that the Russians also have to clear. But I think following this, we can say that the residential areas of Pokrovsk are indeed essentially under Russian control. The Ukrainians have evacuated, and what is now happening is that the Russians are occupying and clearing vacated buildings. They have to do so carefully. Some of these buildings might have been mined. The Ukrainians might have left booby traps behind them. Things like that probably are taking place. There are undoubtedly pockets of left behind Ukrainian troops still scattered in various places across Pokrovsk. But it's essentially now a case of the Russians moving in and taking over empty buildings. And I spoke yesterday in my program about how Russian military police appear to be entering Pokrovsk and setting up barriers and checkpoints, and that also now speaks essentially of a clearing operation, no longer actual battles taking place in the Pokrovsk area. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry then says this about Mirnograd. It says that in Mirnograd, units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade, 51st Army, are in the offensive in the Vostochny micro district and the southern part of Mirnograd and towards the Zapadny micro district. In the past 24 hours, over 200 Ukrainian troops, a British-made Spartan armored personnel carrier, a Kazakh armored fighting vehicle, and 6 pickup trucks have been neutralized in the Pokrovsk area. Now, notice that the Russians are not telling us how many buildings they have cleared in Mirnograd. I get the impression that what the Russians are trying to do, and there are reports about this, is that they're trying to get the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, allegedly, according to some reports, 2,000 of them now, given that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk have basically joined them. Anyway, what is happening is that the Russians are trying to persuade these Ukrainian troops to surrender. And there are some claims that the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd have been given an ultimatum to surrender and have been told that unless they do, over the period of this ultimatum, then the Russians will move in and a battle will follow. And the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd are no longer in a position to put up much resistance. And, well, I don't want to try to guess or imagine what will happen to those Ukrainian soldiers if such an attack does indeed take place. But notice again that the Russians are saying that 200 men from the Ukrainian army have been neutralized. That could mean killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. But again, I think that since the start of the encirclement of Pokrovsk, that is the biggest total. I think that, again, this implies a collapse of Ukrainian resistance in the Pokrovsk Mirnograd area. Anyway, that is what the Russian Defense Ministry is telling us. Of course, there is an alternative view. Now, yesterday, I discussed this confrontation that took place between General Gnatov, of the chief of the General Staff of Ukraine, and President Zelensky. That Gnatov was talking about the Ukrainian General Staff making critically important decisions which they seemed unwilling to share with Zelensky, and an annoyed looking Zelensky pushing back and insisting that Pokrovsk must be defended because its fall might cause doubts in the West about Ukraine's ability to hold on to Donbass, and that was something that Ukraine, or at least Zelensky, could not afford to happen. And I mentioned that over the course of this discussion, General Sirski, who is after all the military chief, Ukraine's official military chief, did not seem to be involved in this discussion, at least not to the extent that I was aware. And I wondered what had happened to him. Well, he has resurfaced over the last 24 hours. He said that the situation in the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd area is under control. He said that Russian attacks have reduced in intensity. By the way, the Institute for the Study of War has been saying the same thing, though they say that it's likely that Russian attacks will increase in intensity over the next few days. Of course, if the Russians are clearing buildings in Pokrovsk and are trying to negotiate the surrender of Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, that might indeed reduce the intensity of Russian attacks, or at least of the fighting. But obviously, talking in that way about a reduced intensity in that case would be a rather peculiar point of view, just saying. Anyway, Sirski then went on to say that, you know, the situation was under control, the intensity of Russian operations, for the moment at least, appears to have reduced. He said that there are around 50,000 Russian troops engaged in the Pokrovsk operation. I think that might be roughly the correct number, but I would say that the Ukrainians have been all over the place in giving numbers of Russian troops involved in the Pokrovsk operation. At one point, a few weeks ago, they were saying that the Russians had committed 110,000 troops to the capture of Pokrovsk. Then other Ukrainian reports increased that number to 170,000. Then another Ukrainian report reduced it to 27,000. Now we have Sirski saying that it's 50,000. Now, these reports, by the way, are not necessarily wrong or mutually exclusive to each other. It may be that different Ukrainian commentators are counting and combining different units, different Russian operational units involved in different parts of the battle. So let's say the 27,000 men might be just the Russian soldiers in Pokrovsk itself. It may be that Sirski's 50,000 includes the Russian troops in Mirnograd and in the area northeast of Pokrovsk. The 110,000 might include other Russian troops involved in other operations, perhaps further to the west. Who knows? But it doesn't nonetheless give much confidence about Ukrainian accounts of this battle, that we've been given these completely different figures, which are at such extraordinary variations to each other. And I, for one, no longer know, or am even going to try to guess how many Russian troops in the battle are actually involved. Anyway, and then Sirsky also said that the 425th Assault Regiment Skala, which is a special forces unit, continues its efforts to break through into Pokrovsk. Sirsky didn't quite admit that Pokrovsk and Mirnograd are encircled, and he certainly didn't say that Pokrovsk itself has been abandoned by the Ukrainians, as independent reports say, and as the latest report from the Russian Ministry of Defense also implies. But anyway, according to him, this regiment, the 425th Regiment Skala, is indeed busy in this area and is indeed engaged in all kinds of battles in this area. And here it must be said that the Russian Defense Ministry has indeed confirmed that the Skala Assault Regiment, the 425th Skala Assault Regiment, is indeed busy, and its account of what it's doing is as follows. Russian troops repelled 7 Ukrainian attacks to unblock the encircled units in the area of Gryshino. In addition, 2 attempts of the 425th Skala Assault Regiment of the Ukrainian military to break through the encirclement in northern and northwestern directions have been thwarted. Now, this is a somewhat complex paragraph, because it talks about Ukrainian attacks to unblock units in the area of Gryshino. I'm assuming that what is meant here is that the Ukrainian troops have been conducting attacks from Gryshino. This appears to be consistent with what Sirsky himself is saying. And also, the Defense Ministry says that the Ukrainians, the 425th Assault Skala Assault Regiment, tried to conduct breakthrough attempts in northern and northwestern directions. That could be that it's trying to break out of Pokrovsk, as opposed to trying to break into Pokrovsk. But I'm not absolutely sure about this. But anyway, the key thing is they say that all of these attacks have been repelled. For the record, the 425th Assault Regiment is apparently, as I said, a special forces regiment. There are various subunits of it operating on many parts now of the Ukrainian front lines. Some apparently are not in Pokrovsk at all. It could be that there are units that have been caught in the cauldron inside Pokrovsk and which are trying to break out. And it could also be that there are other units in the area of Gryshino and in the area of the Russian breakthrough northeast of Pokrovsk in Rodinskoye trying to break in. Just saying. But anyway, it does look as if the battle for Pokrovsk is now coming to its point of crisis. And as I said, reports circulating not confirmed by the Russian Defense Ministry, that the remaining Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd have been given an ultimatum by the Russians to lay down their arms and to surrender en masse. Now, the Russian Defense Ministry has also provided information about the situation in Kupiansk. We've had, again, one of those two commanders of the Russian forces in Kupiansk, Lovets, who we're told is a commander of the 1486th Motorized Rifle Regiment. Anyway, he's now provided us his update of what's going on in Kupiansk. He says, our detachment continues to operate in the industrial area in the east of Kupiansk. This would be on the east bank of Kupiansk, on the east bank of the Oskol River. We have liberated an industrial bakery over the past 24 hours. We have made significant progress along Dzerzhinsky Street, liberating seven large buildings and a factory-based technical construction, which Ukrainian troops used as a fortification. We're conducting reconnaissance and engaging the enemy in a green belt to the southeast of the Olivino railway station. We continue to ram ahead. The task we have set will be accomplished. And then the Russian Defense Ministry says that assault units of the 6th Army continue to destroy encircled Ukrainian troops close to Kupiansk. Three attacks of the 92nd Assault Brigade of the Ukrainian military and the 1st National Guards Brigade to unblock the encircled formations were repelled near Blagodatovka and Petrovka in Kharkiv region. And in fact, there's apparently been video footage which shows the Russians advancing southwards on the east and west banks of the Oskol River. And we've had, as I said, this report of the Russians gradually clearing the area of the cauldron on the east bank of the Oskol River as well. So anyway, the cauldrons, the situation in the cauldrons, which is where there's been the most attention, seems to be deteriorating in both cases very fast. We still have, as I said, Sirsky's claims that all is well. At Pokrovsk, I've noticed that the Ukrainians are saying less about Kupiansk. A couple of days ago, Zelensky was saying that the Ukrainians have won the battle of Kupiansk, but video footage from Kupiansk contradicts that, and we have these reports from Russian commanders in the Kupiansk area. Now, all of this is dramatic enough, but it continues the existing trends. Perhaps even more dramatic now is what is taking place in Zaporozhye region, because over the last couple of hours, there are reasons to think that both in the western part of the Zaporozhye battlefronts, on the west bank of the Dnieper River, and in the eastern area of the Zaporozhye battlefronts, close to the territory, close to the city, the town of Guliapolye, that the situation has, the Ukrainian positions are beginning to collapse. Now, in the western areas, in the western area near the Dnieper, there are reports that the Russians are on the brink now of capturing the central area of the town of Stepnogorsk, which, if true, would put the Russians within relatively close reach of the main road from the city of Zaporozhye to Orekhov, certainly close enough for Russian drones to operate over these roads over this road, the supply road, and to significantly obstruct movement of supplies from the city of Zaporozhye to Orekhov. But again, perhaps the more dramatic news appears to be coming from the situation in the eastern area of the Zaporozhye front lines, because we're told that here the villages of Novoye and Sladkoye have both been captured by the Russians. That's what has been said by the Russian Defense Ministry. And I'm not sure exactly where these places are again, but Novoye certainly brings the Russians significantly closer to the road, the main supply road from the north to Gulyapolye. It's located to the south of Uspenivka. And in fact, there's been claims that the Russians have now captured a whole succession of other places, other villages somewhere to the west, Solodke, Rivnopilye, Yablukova. If the Russians do indeed control these villages, have indeed captured these villages, then there is nothing between them and the supply road to Gulyapolye, and most likely that road is going to be cut within the next week or so, beginning what would in effect be, at that point, the siege of Gulyapolye itself. Now, as I said, if this is correct, and as I said, these reports are a combination of claims by the Russian Defense Ministry and apparently the websites of Russian military units, then there has been a big advance by the Russians westwards from the Yanchil River, with the villages along the Yanchil River captured. The Russians are leaping westwards. It would be one of the most rapid advances that the Russians have made since the start of the year on any battlefront. Now, to repeat again, if this is all correct, and it almost certainly is, then we're starting to look at the collapse of Ukrainian defences in Zaporozhye region, east of the city of Zaporozhye itself. It is starting to look as if, probably before the end of the winter, both Orekhov and Gulyapolye will be fully encircled and perhaps might even have fallen. So, events in the south, in Zaporozhye region, are starting to move very fast. They're also starting to move very fast in Kharkiv region, which is another region which I've not discussed at any great detail recently in the conflict. But it looks as if the Russians not only are in the process of clearing the last remaining Ukrainian positions in the town of Volchansk, but that a whole area of territory, a large area of territory in northeast Kharkiv region, north of Kupiansk, is rapidly falling under Russian control. It's my guess is we're talking about something like 15-20% of Kharkiv region if this whole territory is captured by the Russians over the next few weeks. And again, it looks as if Ukrainian resistance here is weak and is disintegrating. And this doesn't actually bring the Russians closer to Kharkiv city. They're already quite close to Kharkiv city, in a number of other places. But if this area of territory collapses under Russian control, with Volchansk already effectively under Russian control, and Kupiansk likely to come under Russian control very soon, then we will be looking at the second big siege of Kharkiv, about to happen, the city of Kharkiv. Only this time the Russians will be in a much stronger position than the one they were in 2022, when they absolutely did not have enough men to encircle Kharkiv completely. This time it would be different. So a military crisis right across the front lines. I've not discussed in this program the situation in Liman and Siversk or in Konstantinovka. There are reports of things also happening there, but I am not going to engage in all of those details, in the details of all of that. Some of the reports, especially from Liman, are very sketchy. But one could start to see, well, I'm going to say it, we're not perhaps looking at a collapse yet across the entire front lines in Ukraine. But it's beginning to become understandable why Zelensky is so unwilling to pull back from the towns in Donbass, from Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, is so unwilling to pull back from Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka and these other places. Because given how difficult it is for the Ukrainians to hold back the Russians now anywhere on the front lines, it seems to me that if the Ukrainians do give up this defense line that they have in Donbass, it's not Donbass that they might lose, but frankly, the entirety of eastern Ukraine, east of the Dnieper River, probably quite fast. The Institute of the Study of War, no less, warned about this possibility some weeks ago, when the possibility of the Ukrainians evacuating from Donbass as part of a negotiated deal between the Americans and the Russians, between Trump and Putin, was being mooted. And we could start to see, at least, how that might indeed be true. The only thing now that is perhaps preventing such an outcome is Ukraine's continued control of this defense line created along this line of big towns in Donbass, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, and Pokrovsk, which is, of course, about to be lost. So, anyway, that is my view. Of course, I speak as somebody with no military background at all, but I have been following the war. I've been tracking the war very carefully for the last 4 years since it began in February 2022. I've never known the situation in the war for Ukraine to be as bad and as critical as it looks at the moment. And apparently, the Ukrainian authorities have themselves admitted that October 2025, last month, was the worst ever month for desertions from the Ukrainian military. 21,000 men apparently abandoned their posts in the Ukrainian army in that 1 month. Of course, one must add to that combat losses. One can see that the Ukrainian army is struggling to keep its forces together. And whilst I'm not suggesting that this war is about to end, or that it's going to be all over in a few weeks' time, or anything of that kind, certainly I can see why Roger Boyce, the chief foreign correspondent of the London Times, might have written a week ago that by the spring of 2026, unless there is a radical change, a change which no one can see, it could be all over for Ukraine. He might be wrong about the exact timing, but we can begin to see how things in that kind of way continue to play out. Now, I've discussed in many programs how in the West, for the moment, there is no sign at all of any diplomatic initiative to take the us back, to try to perhaps return to the formula that was agreed by, or appeared to have been agreed by Putin and Trump when they met in Alaska. The formula being, as the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has now disclosed, in all essentials, Istanbul plus, but perhaps, as reports have suggested, modifying that on the basis of a proposal made by Witkoff for the Ukrainians to withdraw from Donbass in return for a temporary ceasefire by the Russians on the Zaporozhye and Kherson front lines. Though, as I discussed in my program yesterday, in his latest interview to the Novosti news agency, Lavrov has made it absolutely clear that as part of a final settlement, the Russians would have still expected that the territory, the entire territory of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, including the two cities of Kherson and Zaporozhye, should be transferred to them. Now, going back to that interview, it's important to say that Lavrov made it quite clear that the Russian demands remain unchanging and pretty much implacable. He was asked this question: has the United States administration informed you of its readiness to recognize Crimea de jure as Russian territory as part of the peace plan? And Lavrov responded as follows: for obvious reasons, we do not disclose the details of our discussions with the American side on the Ukrainian issue. However, when clearly fabricated stories appear in the media, we naturally provide clarifications. And what he's obviously referring to about the fabricated stories was the fabricated stories that have appeared in the Financial Times, the story that Putin bored Trump at the Alaska meeting with a long lecture about the long history of the of Ukraine going back to, was it Yaroslav the Wise, to the 12th century or whatever it was, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky and Stepan Mazepa and the Battle of Poltava and all of that. Anyway, that, as I said already, was clearly a fabricated story. What the Russians did, what Putin actually did, as Lavrov, in an earlier interview to Kommersant, has explained, was that they went through the proposal that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow, which, as Lavrov has now disclosed, was Istanbul plus the Russian Istanbul Plus, the June 2024 proposals, with some modifications, perhaps temporary ceasefires in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Certainly not that long, boring historical lecture that the Financial Times is talking about. And the other clearly fabricated story that the Russians have provided clarification about is the story that Trump called off the summit meeting between himself and Putin in Budapest, because over the course of a memorandum sent to the State Department, the Russian Foreign Ministry, and over the course of a telephone conversation between himself, Lavrov, and US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the Russians stuck to the maximalist demands that they supposedly made in the format of Putin's proposals on June 2024, Istanbul Plus. Lavrov has gone to great lengths over the course of recent interviews to make it clear that those two Financial Times reports were untrue. But then he goes on to say in this latest interview, this is the discussion between the Americans and the Russians on Ukraine, covers a broad range of issues and is by no means confined to a single topic, although some journalists and analysts attempt to portray it as such, which is fundamentally incorrect. Now, that is a very interesting sentence, and it does make one wonder, again, what Lavrov is talking about here. Clearly, he means it's not just about Crimea and recognition of Crimea, Russian control of Crimea de jure by the United States. But I get the sense that he means more than that. My clear sense, and it's been my opinion for some time, based on other things that Lavrov has said, that the Russians believe that over the course of their discussions with Witkoff and Trump, they've had some commitments from the Americans to discuss the broader security architecture in Europe, which was the issue that the Russians brought up back in 2021 when they proposed two draft treaties, one between Russia and the United States, the other between Russia and NATO, which basically centered on the security architecture of Europe and sought to bring a final end to NATO's eastward expansion. So I get the sense that the Russians still are discussing this topic and think wrongly, by the way, that the Americans, Witkoff and Trump, might have made some commitments to discuss this with them also. I don't believe that the Americans ever made any commitments of that nature at all, at least not in their own minds. They might have nodded along with some of the things that the Russians were saying here, but I don't believe that any US administration, not even, or especially not Donald Trump's, is prepared to enter into a discussion with the Russians about the security situation in Europe. I wish they would. I think they should. But I don't think they have. Just saying, and making that quite clear. Anyway, Lavrov then went on to say this, and this is the most important thing that he said, perhaps, in this interview. Let me repeat, in our view, ending the conflict is impossible without fully taking into account Russia's legitimate interests and addressing its root causes. As for Crimea and Sevastopol, the residents of the peninsula exercised their right to self-determination in the March 2014 referendum, voting in favour of reunification with Russia. So the issue of who the peninsula belongs to is resolved for us. So what Lavrov is saying is that it really doesn't matter what the Americans recognise with regard to Crimea. That matter, as far as we are concerned, is settled. The Americans can do what they like about it. But about ending the conflict in Ukraine, addressing the root causes, NATO membership, rights of Russians in Ukraine, Ukraine's neutral status, restraints on its military, on the scale of its military, eliminating the ideology of the 1930s that is so prevalent in Ukraine, denuclearization, all of those things, those remain pertinent. Those remain the root causes which must be addressed, and the need to address those root causes brings us back to the other point that Lavrov is making about legitimate interests. Russia's legitimate interests, neutrality, peace, security on its western borders are, for the Russians, essential as well. The point is that the Russians are making no concessions, no fundamental concessions in terms of their core interests. They've not shown any sign at any point of doing so since the special military operation began. At the time of the Istanbul Agreement, they agreed a draft treaty which took into account, as they saw it, their legitimate interests and which addressed the root causes, which were Ukraine's neutrality and NATO membership and all of the other things that I've talked about. Since then, reflecting the changes on the front lines, their position has hardened. They now are insisting that Zaporozhye and Kherson region must be transferred to Russia, and that the status of Donbass as being under Russian control must be recognised by Ukraine. They've not wavered from these demands, and no one should expect that they will. Talk from the West of bringing the Russians to the negotiating table, which basically amounts to trying to get the Russians to compromise on these demands, that isn't going to happen. And that is what Lavrov has said. Now, we've heard less talk about this from the United States and in Europe at the moment. One gets the sense of an exhaustion in Europe. The Europeans have been unable to resolve the issue of the 140 billion euro loan to Ukraine. The idea of trying to use Russian assets as collateral appears to have foundered in the face of strong opposition from Belgium, with France and Italy now joining in. Slovakia and Hungary have now made it clear that they will not be party to to any such arrangement. And I doubt that's going to change, given that all of the other European states also clearly have doubts. And anyway, for the moment at least, that proposal doesn't seem to be moving forward. And there is no agreement, no consensus of how to continue to fund Ukraine in other respects too. Arms, weapons supplies from the West to Ukraine appear to be running down. The United States, the Western powers, are unable to supply Ukraine with air defense missiles, as we've discussed in many programs. There was a really extraordinary report, but apparently it has been confirmed in the German media, that Ukraine has actually rejected a offer from Germany, a batch of Leopard 2 tanks and Marder infantry fighting vehicles that the Germans were offering. It's perhaps not entirely surprising. The Leopard 2s and the Marders have proved unsuccessful in Ukrainian conditions. They're not able to cope with the Rasputitsa. And some say that they're more of a burden for the Ukrainians than a benefit. And there are stories that Ukrainian tank crews are unhappy about being assigned to Western tanks because those tanks act as a magnet for Russian drones and are basically are extremely vulnerable to attack by Russian drones. And I don't hear it just FPV drones, but bigger drones like the Lancet drones, which continue to be operated by the Russians in prolific quantities on the Ukrainian battlefronts, and which have shown themselves repeatedly to be extremely effective in destroying Western tanks and armoured vehicles. And of course, as I've discussed in many programmes, these tanks are much too heavy to operate in the soft soils of Ukraine. And the maintenance load in operating them is just too high. So the Ukrainians have apparently rejected this batch, and the Germans are now wondering what to do with these tanks. Perhaps they will incorporate them in their own military. But anyway, the Europeans are showing signs of exhaustion. We've had the various meetings of the coalition of the willing, but none of that seems to be going very far. We've had the latest push towards sanctions, the attempts to cut off Russia's oil exports. But my own sense is that these appear to be foundering. The Russians continuing to develop their economic ties with China. I received more information about rare earths and the difficulties, the continued difficulties the US would have in developing, in mimicking China's rare earth capabilities. The US Secretary of State Scott Bessent has said that the Americans have a program to do this within 2 years. But I read an article in the Financial Times which said that this was unrealistic. Industry experts were saying that this was unrealistic. And I've seen other reports, and I had a very interesting email from somebody who is an industry expert who thought that 10 years was a more realistic timeline. I should say that in my experience, 10-year timelines for this kind of thing are much more realistic and rational the Russians had a 10-year timeline starting in around 2015 to develop civil aircraft engines. And that has played out. We're now starting to see these civil aircraft engines appear. And the Russians, to my knowledge, had worked out back in 2023 a 10-year program to achieve parity in chip production. And again, that seems to be realistic. I know that many people don't believe in that program, but I've seen it, and I've actually seen how the first steps along this plan are being successfully realized. And China, for its part, 10 years ago, shortly after Xi Jinping became China's paramount leader, they also initiated all sorts of 10-year programs. And we are, in fact, now starting to see all of those come to fruition as well. So 10-year programs are much more realistic for these kind of things. But anyway, coming back to the sanctions, if China is going to buy Russian oil, then it is not going to be possible to choke off Russia's oil exports. And I was reading again in TASS about the preparations that are underway for Putin's trip to India and the complex negotiations that are taking place between the Russians and the Indians ahead of that visit to sort out and agree various programs and co-production deals. And some of these are very, very ambitious. If this trip goes ahead, and there's no sign so far that it is going to be called off, then I can't imagine that India seriously is thinking of calling off, abandoning oil imports from Russia either. So, as I said, I get a sense of general wariness in the West. There's no real sign that the Alaska proposals are going to be revived. They continue to be anathema, both for Zelensky and in Europe. And I get no sense that the Trump administration at the moment feels that it has the political energy or the capital to move ahead with those proposals either. If I go back to Lavrov's interview, he speaks again about how even the negotiations to sort out issues about diplomatic representation between Russia and the United States and to move ahead on other things have come to a standstill. And he provides, by the way, the first Russian account of the conversation between Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States in 2016, and Donald Trump's then national security advisor, Michael Flynn. He says that it is important the dialogue should not be limited solely to embassy-related matters. We consider it essential to address broader questions, including the restoration of direct flights and the return of Russian diplomatic property that was illegally seized by the Obama administration in December 2016, just 3 weeks before the first inauguration of Donald Trump. At that time, then National Security Advisor designate Michael Flynn contacted our ambassador and on behalf of the incoming US president, urged us not to respond sharply to the outgoing Democratic administration's provocations, saying they would sort out everything upon moving into the White House. We are still waiting. Our proposals regarding both diplomatic property and air service have been conveyed to the American side. So one gets the sense that the Americans are not prepared to move on these things. And my sense also is that the political energy in Washington to do that simply isn't there. My own feeling is that President Trump has a whole lot of other matters to worry about at the moment. His negotiators have managed to agree with some Democratic senators, enough Democratic senators, on a formula which is basically, by the way, as far as I can see, favourable to him, to end the government shutdown. But there are no growing signs that the US economy is falling deeper into recession. I noticed that we still have not had an operation against Venezuela, so there may be doubts about that. Maybe overall, after the electoral setbacks that the president suffered last week, he's heeding finally the advice of his vice president and is focusing on domestic policy. But I don't get the sense that he's really interested at the moment in plunging forward with diplomatic initiatives in Ukraine. And in Europe, they don't seem to be thinking about doing that either. I can understand the reasons for President Trump's reluctance, though he should be aware that if, as I expect, some kind of military crisis is indeed going to develop in Ukraine in the winter or the spring, he's going to have to deal with that in some form or other, and it might be a good idea to address it now. But in Europe, given the fact that the economies of Europe and the political situation there of the various governments continue to deteriorate, this exhaustion seems to me to be disastrous. In Britain, there's been a recent opinion poll which puts the governing Labour Party, Keir Starmer's Labour Party, third after Reform and the Greens. Reform is on 32%, the Greens are on 17%, Labour and Conservative are tied on 16%. Reform, in other words, currently is polling as much as Labour and Conservatives are together, at least according to this poll. And the British government, the Starmer government, has now, through a statement made by the Finance Minister, Chancellor Rachel Reeves, clearly signalled that that income tax for all British taxpayers is going to be increased at the forthcoming budget in 3 weeks' time. And that, I predict, is also going to be very unpopular with British voters, especially since it breaks a manifesto commitment, a promise that the government made before it was elected. So, none of these European governments address the elephant in the room, one of the major reasons why there is a crisis in Europe, which is, of course, the economic war that is being waged against Russia and the terrible toll this is taking of European economies, especially as their energy costs continue to be so much higher than those of their competitors. I would have thought that political leaders, conscious of the budgetary crisis aware of these warnings from the European Commission that unless this loan based on the Russian assets is finally agreed, European governments are going to have to take out more loans in order to continue to fund Ukraine. Given all of this, I would have thought that European governments would now be under considerable pressure, political pressure, or would find themselves under political pressure, and would be thinking about initiating at least some kind of dialogue with the Russians to find a way out of this crisis, especially given the deterioration of the military situation in Ukraine, about which they cannot any longer be under any real doubt. But apart from a few sane voices like Lord Skidelsky, who continues to speak about the need to send diplomats to Moscow to talk to the Russians, nothing of any sort is being done. Exhaustion reigns there also. This cannot last within a few weeks, months. We're going to have a major crisis on our hands. And, well, when that happens, I predict that exhaustion and despondency is going to be replaced by panic. And panic is the worst state in which to make the kind of difficult decisions which the Europeans and the Americans are going to have to make. Well, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget also to check out our new Substack, blog. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.